November 2016, Mr. Trump won the U.S. presidency, not least by appealing to reactionary voters in the United States on the platform of Islamophobia, attacking American Muslims in particular.
Once again, the D.C. Zoning Commission has sold the people out. They have approved a redevelopment plan that will inevitably displace hundreds of families from a community that they've lived in for decades.
Journalists have been under assault physically and in other ways for a long time, and especially under this Trump White House. So I think it's very much connected to Julian Assange. Reporters really ought to be taking up the case of Assange and saying, no, we need to protect whistleblowers. We need to make it possible for people to reveal information that is in the public interest that the government doesn't want us to know. Because that, after all, is the job of journalism. Anything else is really, as they say, stenography.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C., I'm Esther Ivarum, and on today's show, it's our special focus on culture and media for the fourth Friday. Here in D.C., family and friends of Sharnice Milton are marking the second anniversary of her unsolved murder. Milton was a young journalist shot and killed in Southeast D.C. 2 years ago. Now a community bookstore is being launched and named in her honor. Also, Janine Jackson, host of Counterspin, is back with us to talk about many media things, including the government's double standard for leaking so-called confidential information and double standards for coverage of the so-called war on terrorism and what innocent civilians are worthy of news coverage. And in the second half, the cell phone, tablet, and wireless technology is so ubiquitous that we have become somewhat oblivious to its dangers. But scientists and activists are sounding the alarm. You don't want to miss that discussion to stay informed and to keep you and your loved ones safe. All that is coming up. Now, our headlines from D.C. this week. President Trump made headlines because of his cozy relationship with blood-soaked regimes in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the Philippines. And while out of the country, he dropped his proposed budget that human rights advocates characterize as a harsh attack on the American people. Deborah Weinstein, executive director of the Coalition on Human Needs, said that, quote, "For those who thought the budget would provide investments to create jobs, that promise is broken. Cutting trillions of dollars from needed services will slow our economy. Education cuts will make it harder for people to qualify for good jobs." She added, "The budget would massively transfer money that should be invested in all our people to a handful of millionaires and profitable corporations through multi-trillions in tax cuts that would average $50,000 for each millionaire." End quote. Now for more news about how real issues are impacting real people this week, I'm joined by our geopolitical analyst, historian, and prolific author, Gerald Horn. Gerald, of course, a big media story this week is the horrific bombing at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England, that killed at least 22 people. In contrast, there's not so much media attention on the bombs the UK and the US are complicit in dropping on children in Yemen and in Libya, where the presumed bomber has roots. So what's your take today?
What's even more striking about the Manchester bombing that you just made reference to is that the mainstream press has refused adamantly to connect the dots. That is to say that these bombs, in a metaphorical, if not literal sense, that were detonated in Manchester were actually constructed in the chaos of Libya that was delivered by the ill-advised 2011 overthrow of the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi by the U.S.-led and British-led NATO forces. Strikingly, Jeremy Corbyn, who is trying to be the next British prime minister, has now pledged to drop the war on terror as the operative framework for British foreign policy. And it seems to me that he's trying to connect the dots between ill-advised British foreign policy and bombings that you saw take place in Manchester. Mm-hmm. But sadly and tragically, that kind of connection has yet to be made by mainstream politicians in the United States of America.
You know, you speaking of Corbyn, I did hear that sound clip where he was making those connections, connecting those dots. There seems to be almost a media blackout on him. I don't see much coverage about him and his campaign, which seems to be written off by the mainstream press.
You are correct, but keep in mind that the latest polls show that he is behind Prime Minister Theresa May. That is to say, the Labour Party is behind the Tories by a scant 5 percentage points. And I think that it's possible for the Labour Party to close that gap before the election, which takes place in less than 2 weeks.
Well, since we were mentioning Libya, I don't want to fail to mention on this show that this month, 80 more of the schoolgirls kidnapped in Nigeria 3 years ago were at least recently returned home, and that their kidnapping of almost 300 girls spawned the, bring back our girls or bring our girls home campaign. And, I guess what we could call the success of the kidnappers, the group Boko Haram, is connected to the same destabilization of Libya and the assassination of Gaddafi. So, what is the latest that we should know about the impact, not only in Europe that people have been witnessing this week, but also in Africa?
Well, with regard to Africa, you are correct in suggesting a connection between the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in 2011, which leads to chaos spreading southward into Mali, which eventually trickles into northern Nigeria, which gives a boost to Boko Haram, which has been given responsibility for the kidnappings that you made reference to. But unfortunately, there was a recent report that suggested that one of the problems in confronting Boko Haram is that the Nigerian military is basically siphoning off billions that are being donated to help them fight Boko Haram for their own narrow purposes. Mm-hmm. And as long as that is the case, it seems to me that Boko Haram will receive an extended lease on life.
Well, here in the U.S., not getting much corporate media attention is a huge victory this week for voting rights. So I want you to tell us a little bit more about this week's Supreme Court decision and why it's so important.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion penned by Elena Kagan, who is a leader of the so-called liberal bloc on the high court, made a ruling with regard to the congressional district in North Carolina of former Congressional Black Caucus member Mel Watt. What happened is that the North Carolina legislature, dominated by Republicans, tried to pack in more black voters into Mel Watt's district in order to create more steadily reliable Republican, mostly white districts. Justice Kagan fundamentally said that race can be used as a factor in crafting electoral districts, but not the predominant factor. But in the wider scheme of things, I think perhaps the most important aspect of this ruling was that the most conservative justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm speaking of Justice Clarence Thomas, who, of course, is a black American, sided with the liberal bloc with regard to this particular opinion. I'll leave it to others to ascertain whether or not this is a straw in the wind or whether it was just a one-off on Justice Thomas's part.
Wow. And then finally, in the news, Cornell Brooks was, I want to say, ousted as head of the NAACP. The board voted not to renew his contract as of next month, the end of next month. So there might be some backstory to this that you can share?
Well, what's striking about the NAACP is that they've been changing leaders more regularly than some change underwear. In recent years, there's been Ben Jealous, there's been Bruce Gorton, there's been Ben Chavis, there's been Kwesi Mfume. But I think that the board of the NAACP has refused to grasp the problem, which is that instead of changing leaders, they should change the line. What I mean is, in the late 1940s, beginning then, they began to oust from positions of influence in the NAACP socialists like W.E.B. Du Bois and others to his left. Then in the 1950s and 1960s, they began to attack black nationalists like Malcolm X. I found it quite striking that this decision of the NAACP board ousting Mr. Brooks was made on Malcolm X's birthday, May 19th. So what that means is that the NAACP has basically systematically shrunk its base. Its base has been shrunk to consisting of either churchgoers and or liberals, and leaving on the sidelines those of the left and those who happen to be black nationalists. Until that line is changed, I think we can look forward to the NAACP consistently and persistently sacking its leaders for supposedly being unable to build a militant fight-back organization that's so desperately needed in this era of resistance to Donald J. Trump.
Right, and I read a few commentators mention what we, most of us that cover the movement, know, that the NAACP has been kind of outshined by and, you know, outworked by a series of younger, more energetic movements like Color of Change and the Movement for Black Lives and BYP 100, just people who are out there on the, you know, on the ground, on the front lines, you know, fighting for social justice. So,
well, that's correct. But once again, it's an easy enough problem to solve. Unfortunately, I think that this has a lesson for Pacifica as well. That is to say that one of the reasons that the NAACP shuns those of the left and black nationalists because they're trying to pander to and cater to their corporate donor base. Obviously, Pacifica has been able to avoid that snare thus far.
Okay. Well, we'll be sure to continue to follow these stories and speak again soon. I've been speaking with our geopolitical analyst, historian, and author, Gerald Horn. Thank you, Gerald, for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, issues of labor, affordable housing, and public safety are center stage here in the nation's capital region, just as they are around the country. The working families of Brooklyn Manor in Northeast D.C. are in the final rounds of fighting to keep their apartment homes. Chantal James has more.
Once again, the D.C. Zoning Commission has sold the people out. They have approved a redevelopment plan that will inevitably displace hundreds of families from a community that they've lived in for decades. So we're extremely disappointed. You know, they claim that there are these quote-unquote caveats. They have not addressed the fact that the numbers don't add up. 535 units, they're replacing those with 373, restricting 200 of them for seniors only. Mm-hmm. There are many more than 173 families on the property, and they will have nowhere to go once they eliminate the family-sized units and once they eliminate the affordable units. So we're extremely disappointed, but we're unsurprised.
Is this the last step?
Absolutely not. We're just getting started.
That was one D.C. organizer, Yasmina Marabid, from the courtroom where the D.C. Zoning Commission had just decided to displace hundreds of hardworking people after less than an hour of deliberation. On Monday, dozens of residents of the Northeast D.C. housing complex known as Brooklyn Manor rallied at One Judiciary Square to appeal to the Zoning Commission once more. This was to be the evening that the commission decided the fate of the many working-class families who had been calling Brooklyn Manor home for generations. To the deep disappointment of those who had come together, the Zoning Commission financial corps to blaze forks and build luxury apartments in its place. But the spirit of resistance of the residents of Brooklyn Manor could not be stifled. In their continued commitment to the cause of affordable housing for themselves and folks all across the city, young resident Mariana Richardson raised her voice shortly before the hearing in duet with longtime activist Lucy Murphy about the need for Brooklyn Manor residents of all ages to stay exactly where they are.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
When we hold together.
When we hold together.
We make ourselves strong.
We make ourselves strong.
Together we stay here.
Together we stay here.
Right where we belong.
Right where we belong.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
We ain't gonna move.
Yeah. To find out how you can help the Brooklyn Manor residents in their continued struggle, visit onedconline.org. From Judiciary Square, this is Chantal James.
Thank you, Chantal. And in happenings, tomorrow, May 27th, from 3 to 7 p.m., there will be a book drive and memorial cookout honoring the life of Sharnice Milton, a 27-year-old journalist who was struck and killed by a stray bullet 2 years ago while she was waiting for a bus in Southeast D.C. her murder remains unsolved. Milton, a native of D.C., was fiercely committed to her community and wrote with passion about its people and politics for the publications The Hill Rag and East of the River. Tomorrow's event is free, and it will also feature a performance by EU and Sugar Bear. And for more information, go to weacradio.org. Also tomorrow, May 27th, the 45th anniversary of the celebration of African Liberation Day will be marked here in D.C. with a parade and march, followed by a program at Union Temple, 1225 W Street in Southeast D.C. More information is at alduhuru.org. That's alduhuru.org. And today is the last day to pre-register for the June 3rd Hope Without Boundaries 5K Run Walk at the National Harbor to benefit the organization Black and Missing, a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to bring awareness to missing persons of color, provide vital resources and tools to missing persons' families and friends, and to educate the minority community on personal safety. Proceeds from the event will go towards funding for families of the missing, flyer distribution, financial support, victim recovery, and burial assistance. Information is at hwb5k.org. That's hwb5k.org. And those are headlines and happenings. When we come back, the war against real journalism. Stay with us.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum. Well, for this segment, we're going to talk about how journalists, news organizations, and the role of news coverage continues to be a big story. With me for this monthly extended focus on culture and media is Janine Jackson, media critic and host of the nationally syndicated show Counterspin. Welcome back to the show, Janine.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's difficult to know where to start. A reporter for The Guardian newspaper was assaulted Wednesday by Greg Gianforte, the Republican candidate for Congress in Montana, who did not like the questions being asked him. And, you know, he was charged with assault, actually. So with all that happening, you know, and that's just in this country, you know, around the world, journalists are under assault and even worse. But we have to try to focus. So I want to know the stories this month from Counterspin that you would like to highlight.
Well, you know, you don't want to go too far from concern for journalists getting beat up. That's for sure. That's always going to be high on our list. And we should certainly be paying attention to that. But some other stories that I've been able to do this month, well, one in particular I would love to highlight, which was from around Mother's Day, and that was to talk about National Mama's Bailout Day. I had the pleasure of speaking with a woman named Arissa Hall, who works at the National Bail Fund Network, and she was talking about a very successful action that happened around Mother's Day in which people pulled their resources around the country and got some money to get some black women who were incarcerated simply for the inability to pay bail and got them out so they could be home with their families for Mother's Day. And it was about calling attention to the really cruel and unfair bail system that we still have in this country. But I liked it so much because it also was just a human to human, you know, it's humans helping one another. And also calling attention to a bigger problem. So I love to spotlight a story like that, an activism story that calls attention to a problem but shows that there are folks that are working on it and shows you ways to get involved. And National Mama's Bailout Day was a great, great example of that. I was happy to talk about it.
Hey, that was awesome. You know, the movement for Black Lives, the people at BYP 100, this organization you spoke to,
Color Change.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they amaze me with the way that they are able to keep reminding us of the ways that the criminal justice system is not only unfair, but how it's normalized very unfair treatment of people.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think spearheaded by a woman named Mary Hooks from SONG, Southerners on New Ground, which is a fabulous activism group. And I think we often overlook the South when we're thinking about where activism is going on. And that is a mistake because there's a lot of exciting work being done, including by SONG. She pointed out that Black people have a long history of helping one another out, you know, of buying one another's freedom, literally, and that this is part of that tradition, but that it calls attention to, you know, something that people think is maybe behind them. Or they think we have a criminal justice system that's unfair, but they don't unpack the racism involved in it. They don't recognize that, and I think many people don't actually know, that we have a lot of people, thousands and thousands of people who have not been convicted of any crime at all, who are sitting in jail, who are unable to be with their families, who are unable to go to their job simply because of the amount of cash.
Right, and they lose their job, and they lose sometimes their home or their apartment, and in some cases of these women, they lose their children. You know, and so it's you know, yeah, just a tremendous story that I know we tried to highlight on our show, and that did get picked up in, you know, a lot of places that don't seem to care really about those stories. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. I was very interested, and I spoke with Arissa Hall about it, and she agreed that the coverage was not as cynical or not as critical as we kind of thought or worried that it might be, that people did seem to recognize the heart at the center of the action, but then they also did seem to recognize the patent unfairness. Certainly it goes against everything that Americans like to tell themselves they are. If you say that, well, a rich man and a poor man can be in the same situation and the rich man will go free simply because he's rich, that's exactly the type of thing that Americans like to say doesn't happen here because we have the law that is an equalizer and everyone's equal before the law. Well, we know that's a joke. Mama's Bailout Day was a way of not just reminding us that that's not the case, but of showing us something that we can do about it.
Right. Well, since we spoke last, there have been developments with Julian Assange. The prosecutors in Sweden decided not to go forth with this case against him, but he's still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because of charges that he may face there in the UK. They have made it clear that if he still steps outside the embassy, that they will arrest him. So it made me think about how there's this whole double standard about what leaks are criminalized. And we talked a little bit about it last month, but we're like swimming in leaks right now. You know, and what information you're leaking about who, that will determine whether you are criminalized for that. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about that from your perspective, what you see happening.
Well, you have to realize a couple of things. Number one, media outlets calling for the prosecution of Julian Assange are very confused about what exactly the business of journalism is my understanding, because journalism is revealing the actions of powerful people, in this case the government, those things that they don't want you to know, as long as they are in the public interest. The government is really, really good at getting out all the information they want to get out that they want us to know. And as you have said, pick up any newspaper and you will find, generally on the front page, anonymous sources, unnamed sources from the government. And they are not anonymous because they are revealing something that they might lose their job if they revealed, or because they might be retaliated against. They're anonymous to just plant an idea that the White House, for example, wants to get out, or the Defense Department wants to get out, without accountability. So when you talk about the Espionage Act, when you talk about criminalizing Chelsea Manning's revelations or Julian Assange's revelations, what people need to understand is that the law doesn't just penalize the person who revealed the information. The law would also criminalize the media outlet that receives it. Journalists who are attacking Assange and attacking Chelsea Manning don't seem to understand that they are part of that relationship, and that if the Espionage Act comes for the leakers, it can come for them too. This is an egregious misunderstanding under a Trump White House, and it does. We started out talking about reporters actually being beaten. But the journalists have been on days for a long time, and especially under this Trump White House. So I think it's very much connected to Julian Assange. Reporters really ought to be taking up the case of Assange and saying, no, we need to protect whistleblowers. We need to make it possible for people to reveal information that is in the public interest that the government doesn't want us to know. Because that, after all, is the job of journalism. Anything else is really, as they say, stenography.
Right. And, you know, I wonder how important do you think this law that Obama signed before he left office is playing a part? The Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act. And we've talked about, like, well, are we going to let this government decide what is disinformation and what is propaganda? That connects to what you were just saying. So how much do you think that this act that he signed is playing into how the Trump White House or these senior officials are viewing their powers now?
You know, I'm not sure how much that act actually changed. I think it was a way of just putting some wind behind the efforts that were happening anyway. Certainly we've seen a Trump White House has no hesitancy in reaching out to say things that then turn out not even to be legal, you know, but they just say they're going to go ahead and do it. I think that was kind of a last kind of ditch effort to put a stake in this fake news argument and to suggest that, that that might be the reason that the Democrats lost the election, and that might be the real enemy that we all ought to be really fighting, and that's at best a misdirection. I'm not sure that it gives people really any legal ground to stand on in terms of persecution of journalists, prosecution of journalists. Those things are meant to be against the law no matter what. Why it's right. disturbing is because, just as you say, it sort of deputizes state actors to determine which news outlets they want to declare are fake, and which they want to grant the kind of imprimatur of legitimate news sources. That's not something that government should be in the business of doing at any time, So I think it just kind of created further confusion, but these folks felt unleashed on November 8th, that folks who have always wanted to put journalism in check, to make journalists basically mouthpieces for the state and for corporations, to curtail their independence. That's always been on the agenda of the Trump White House. We've seen that since the arrests of journalists at the inauguration, and as listeners know, some of the journalists were released, but some of those protesters are still in jail and facing felony charges. This White House has always wanted to clamp down on dissent, and to the extent that journalists represent any kind of critical thinking or dissent, they want to clamp down on them too.
Yeah, we actually had a number of demonstrations here in support of, I think, the J20 journalists you're talking about, because the last I looked, all but one have had the charges dropped. And the one remaining journalist, and this was as of maybe a week ago, was this lone independent journalist who was live streaming. And it reminded me, because, having worked in corporate media, how you feel like you have more protection. They're not going to so quickly go after you when you're working for one of these powerful corporations. But when you're by yourself and you're working independently, I think they feel a little more leeway in kind of coming after you and trying to make some charges stick. So hopefully the one remaining journalist, and I apologize, I don't have his name right in front of me, but hopefully those charges will be dropped as well.
And that's where the community needs to step in. I would love to see, corporate journalists or big media defending independent journalists, defending citizens journalists who they have to recognize are doing the same job. Whenever we see footage of a police violence, for example, you'll see that journalists, mainstream journalists, will take that footage and run it, 20 ways from Sunday. But if the individual, the citizen journalist who took that footage is retaliated against by the police, well, those mainstream journalists are nowhere to be found, and we have
right.
seen this in a number of cases where the folks who take the video are arrested, have their cameras taken, have their phones taken, are sometimes harassed,
Right.
Ramsey Orta is a case here in New York. And we really need to see journalists recognizing it's part of the Assange conversation. Journalists need to be recognizing that journalism can happen lots of different ways in lots of different places, and we have to value it wherever it happens and defend the people who are doing it, even if they don't have, the corporate sanction that you might have. But yeah, you will find that you, as a reporter, if you work for a big outlet, you may get arrested, but your people are going to come for you. They're going to bail you out, whereas the freelancer who maybe is, doesn't have a big outlet behind him, he could be just hung out to dry. That's where we need the community of journalists to act as a community.
So, I get really bugged, watching. I'm kind of a news junkie, so I'll watch different kinds of news, but at the same time, start talking back to the TV and yelling at it and everything. So I was really going to start, I really wanted to talk about just the skewed coverage of Syria and particularly Venezuela. That really bothers me. We've talked to Venezuelan officials here and kind of get their side of the story, and we have that luxury and privilege here, and I'm really happy to do so. But it doesn't really change the fact that for like 90% of the outlets are presenting a very skewed view of what's happening there. And so I wanted to talk about that. But since then, we've had this horrific attack in Manchester in England, right? And we see how, not to take away anything from the horror there, how those victims are treated and how that kind of attack and terror is treated, as opposed to what's
continuing to happen in Yemen, what's continuing to happen in Syria and Iraq, where, you know, we killed like 2 million people. So just feeling all the weight of this kind of skewed coverage is just a little overwhelming for me. I mean, I don't know how you kind of deal with that in terms of your work that you do.
Well, it can be overwhelming, because one of the things you realize as either a media critic or a media junkie is the power of influence that media have. Even when you imagine you're, you know, thinking critically and holding yourself a bit apart and really examining what you're reading, it still influences you. It's powerful to see a tabloid headline that has a picture of a child who was killed, and it says angel, you know, and then next mm-hmm. to it a picture of the suspect, and it says demon, you know. That is a powerful emotional manipulation that happens. And you have to be aware of the fact that different situations could be presented that way. We could be seeing everyday pictures of, you know, U.S. soldiers labeled demon and the children they've killed labeled angels. You know, things, human beings have feelings about things like this, and the media can manipulate them. And so it matters, of course, very, very much which conflicts and which tragedies they choose to focus on. And we know that if there is an act in which there can be any way of connecting the act with Islam, that fits into a predetermined narrative that corporate media love to pump up, that Muslims are the enemy, that Islam is the enemy, that this is the great fight, the clash of civilizations. I mean, we know the whole line. And we also know that there have ample opportunities to talk about other acts of violence in which the U.S., for example, is a perpetrator, or a U.S. ally is a perpetrator, and that they don't do it. So it's absolutely fair to say not, I shouldn't be made to feel sad when something horrible happens in Manchester, but I do have to be aware that there are other stories that are important, other people who are being harmed, and that media are shaping me and directing me to tell me a certain story about who does harm and who is harmed that doesn't match reality.
And who matters.
And who matters. Exactly. Yeah. And who matters. We often see, you know, I mean, Yemen is on the brink of a disastrous famine. It's already begun. A human rights catastrophe. And we don't know the names of people there. You know, we don't see photographs that really identify people and go deeply into their lives and talk about the situation that they're in. You get it every now and again, but you don't get it in an ongoing way such that you would say, you know, what can be done to stop this? And what also happens with the sort of manipulation of acts of terror is that it encourages us to only see violence as the solution to violence. We don't hear from human rights groups who say there might be a diplomatic way forward. We don't hear from groups in the region who might say, you know, we're actually a complicated people with a range of different views, and some of us feel one way and some of us feel another. We don't get that textured coverage. We're just told this place on the map, bad. You know, the only thing to do is bomb. And every expert that I've ever spoken to has said, we simply cannot bomb our way to stability. If what we want to do is to be safer in the world, bombing is not going to get us there. So we need journalists, whether it's Yemen, whether it's Syria, we need journalists to keep that in mind, to keep that in front of us, that upsetting people in such a way that they think, oh, I just want to do something, I'm so mad, or I'm so sad, I just want to do something, that is not the most helpful role for journalists to play, and that sort of policy is not going to be the kind of policy that's going to make the world safer.
Right. Well, I wanted us to have an opportunity, if we could, to move to somewhat lighter topics. And I realize that sometimes it's hard for me to find a lighter topic, you know, but sometimes I do enjoy some things I see, but maybe, you know, they're fleeting. It's fleeting. And then I can't remember when, like, we sit down to talk. But there are two things that I thought of that, Get Out, that, you know, sleeper box office, you know, success, is on pay-per-view now. So people can see it on TV, and it's given it a whole new life for people who didn't see it in theaters, where it grossed more than $220 million, almost $230 million. And it became like the highest grossing film by a black filmmaker ever. And it's given the pay-per-view audience, it's given it a whole new life. And I just happened to be at a party recently where they had it playing. This was one of these like suburban houses that have like a home theater. And they were actually playing it there. And so I guess people hadn't seen it before. And so it had a whole new range of people to get their aha moment.
Isn't that something? I think that's wonderful. That was a real revelation for a lot of folks. Again, I was amazed, as with Mama's Bailout Day, I was amazed at the positive reaction from folks, white and black. And what I would like to see, of course, is, you know, what we never see in Hollywood, and I know we're keeping it light, but you see a film that's very successful, that's about blackness, made by black filmmakers, and you think, well, that can be successful, so maybe we'll see more like that. You know, hopefully we'll see more black filmmakers being given a shot at this.
Exactly.
When you can see how successful it can be. So I hope that apart from its just the impact of the film itself, it's an amazing film, that it will have a kind of a multiplier effect that more black filmmakers and more black films will be out there.
Right. We're going to have to wrap up our little discussion today. But I've been speaking with Janine Jackson, host of the nationally syndicated show Counterspin. Thank you for joining me, Janine.
It's always a pleasure, Esther.
Thank you.
We are going to now go to our final segment for today, and it's focused on the dangers of cell phone use. And this is a subject that the corporate media also does not touch, you know, with all those "Can You Hear Me Now" commercials paying the bills for them. But last month, an Italian court was the first court in the world to recognize a causal link between the cell phone use and the brain when they awarded a telecom employee, Roberto Romeo, lifetime damages of 500 euros per month after he developed a brain tumor from 15 years of cell phone use constantly. The ruling has made international headlines, maybe not here, but internationally, as the court's expert refused to accept the telecom industry-funded studies as evidence. So with me to talk about that case, cases right here in the nation's capital and wireless technology, is Theodora Scarrato, Education Director for the Environmental Health Trust, a scientific virtual think tank conducting cutting-edge research on environmental health. Currently, the think tank is addressing health concerns about cell phones and wireless and recommends reducing exposure to reduce risk. The trust maintains a regularly updated database of worldwide precautionary policies, and more than a dozen countries recommend reducing wireless exposure to children. Thank you for joining me today, Theodora.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, a lot of people hearing this will want to know, what is the danger and how can I protect myself?
Well, you know, going to the right to know, we really have a right to know that cell phones and wireless technology is microwave radiation, which has not been pre-market tested for long-term safety. And in Berkeley, in fact, there's a right to know ordinance that was passed informing people about the fact that cell phones emit microwaves. And there are actually a lot of ways to reduce our exposure. And, of course, in other countries, they're doing so much. France, Belgium, Israel, Cyprus. So, but here in the United States, actually, in some ways, the opposite's happening, where our right to know, just as an example, in Berkeley, the response has been to sue, stating that the industry's right to free speech is being violated by informing the public about this issue. So we're working hard to, and we have a website, Environmental Health Trust, it's ehtrust.org, where we have all kinds of ways that people can reduce exposure to cell phones and wireless.
I know I met you and your group at the Green Festival,
mm-hmm.
and I was really drawn to these really catchy posters, like postcards that you had, and one said, "Protect the Girls," and it had a picture of a woman with like a cell phone kind of tucked into her bra.
Mm-hmm.
And because a lot of women have this habit, or younger people, like maybe they're going to a club, they don't want to have a purse, and they're putting that cell phone like tucked right into their bra. And that's very dangerous. Can you tell us about that? And also, I guess because we don't have a lot of time, for the male part of this, a lot of men put the cell phone in their front pocket. So why are you warning girls and boys to not do this?
Well, actually, in the fine print in the phone, it states there should be a distance between the body and the phone. And tragically, we're finding more and more young women who are developing breast cancer, unusual breast cancers, directly underneath where the phone was when they stored it in their bra.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go on our website and see many stories. There's published case reports on this. In terms of men, when you put a cell phone, and women, actually, who we have ovaries, right? So when you put the cell phone in your pocket, the exposure is to that your lower abdomen, and there is research showing sperm damage and fertility impacts, DNA breaks in the sperm. Mm-hmm. So this is really, it's really a right-to-know issue, and we need to also call on the federal government to enact policy that protects the public.
Right. So I know there are some D.C. cases. We talked about a case in Italy, but you said there are some cases right here working their way through the courts.
Yeah, well, because all independent research is actually showing that people who've used cell phones to their head in the long term, over 10 years, have an increased risk of brain cancer. And those cases, they started in the 90s, but now there are 13 cases that are consolidated and actually moving forward in D.C. Superior Court. So that'll be, it's been 15 years, actually, you know how court cases drag on. But I expect we'll be hearing more about that in the fall, actually.
Okay. Yeah. And real quick, because we are running out of time, and I promise we're going to have you back and we're going to do a longer segment. But quickly, two more things. What is the concern over 5G technology, and what is the so-called Internet of Things that we need to worry about?
This is really important because Washington, D.C. is one of the test cities for 5G. This is going to be a new technology with even more wireless signals that will be moving through the air. They're going to be putting up literally thousands of new cell towers, mini cell towers on residential neighborhoods and streets to increase the Internet of Things is where everything's connected. Your cell phone connects to your appliances, connects to, they have wireless tampons, they have wireless, you know, everything will be connected. And this is a real concern. It's more than a concern because we know that the frequencies that we already have in use have health impacts, and now these new frequencies will be higher millimeter frequencies, which are already used as crowd control weapons by our military at a higher power, but the safety implications need to be immediately addressed. So what's happening is at the federal and state levels, there is legislation moving forward that would actually preempt local zoning rights so that these can be put up. They're calling it streamlining, which really means taking away the rights of the community to decide what they want and where they want this infrastructure.
Right.
So, and again, Washington, D.C. is in line, and
one final thing. I mean, I know that I live in D.C. and you know there was a fight over the smart meters, and I guess we lost. You know, we have smart meters, but the fight still rages on in Maryland. What's happening in Maryland? And we have like 5 seconds.
Yeah. So Maryland Smart Meter Awareness. If you go to that website, whatis5g.info, you can get more information. There is a lot of organizing going on so that we can have legislation that protects people. We also need to call on our federal senators to put a hold on the Mobile Act S-19. And so ehtrust.org, and my email is coordinator@ehtrust.org, and you can contact me for more information.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been in conversation with Theodora Scarrato, Education Director for Environmental Health Trust. Thank you, Theodora, for joining me today, and we're definitely going to have you back again because these are really serious issues that we need to keep reminding people about because, you know, people just think of their cell phone as just a phone.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that will about do it for today's show. Get those phones out of your pocket and put them somewhere, like in a purse if you're a woman. If you're a guy, you carry a backpack. Put them in your backpack. Do something. Get it away from your body. Okay, so I want to thank Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, and our engineer, Michael Red Eagle Nacella. We love to hear from you. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows and volunteer to work on the show. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. There's a green picket sign that says On the Ground. I'm Esther Avaram. Raise your voice out there. Peace.